Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. I'm Chris Benda, theological librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Idit Dobbs Weinstein, associate professor of philosophy, Jewish studies, and Graduate Department of Religion, about her recent book, Spinoza's Critique of Religion and Its Heirs, Marx, Benjamin, Adorno.
Just a couple of corrections to be aware of in the upcoming interview. About three-fifths of the way through the interview, the purported Mandarin that Professor Dobbs Weinstein mentions should be Adorno, not Spinoza. And about an hour into the interview, Hermann Cohen, not Solomon Maimon, is the foremost Jewish philosopher of the early part of the 20th century in Germany, while Habermas, not Heidegger, is the one trying to rescue Benjamin from Adorno. And now, back to the interview.
Idit, thank you for being willing to be interviewed.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Spinoza's Critique of Religion and Its Heirs is concerned with understanding a number of thinkers, as you say, concretely, materially, and historically. Mm-hmm. And we'll explore how you do that in the questions that follow. But I first wanted to ask, what were the concrete material historical circumstances that led you to write this book?
Okay. To answer this question adequately, of course, would require the entire interview time. So let me begin with voicing three distinct but inseparable aspects of the motivation for writing this book, and importantly, writing it now. Mm-hmm. Okay, because in many ways, this book interrupted, its urgency for me interrupted another book I was... This is a third part of a project, and the second part was put on hold because of its urgency now, in my view. Okay, the first motivation is expressed explicitly in the preface to the book. Its origins are two gaping or abysmal absences of grandparents and family, and of a young Arab girl to whom I was deeply attached in Jaffa when I was a baby. In the light of Walter Benjamin's claim that living is a living of traces, living is a living of traces, this book makes good that claim, for nowhere else are there traces of them. Most important, second, since history is a history of the victor, and since the victor has not ceased to be victorious, this book is an attempt to guard against the loss of the victim or their suffering to remembrance, consigning them to a second and final death. As an aside, when possible, I avoid the language of memory because it is heavily sedimented by Christoplatonism, a faculty of an autonomous subject as distinct from the practice of a community, remembrance. Okay, third, and in this light, what is at stake for me, okay, can be stated as whose history, which politics. And in fact, I wanted the title to have that too, in other words, to have three parts, but Cambridge balked at having a three-part title, because I really wanted it as whose history, which politics. And in this, in whose history, which politics, I include also which history of philosophy, what political philosophy. In other words, for me, the issue are not just these three concrete thinkers, but what do we mean by history, and what do we mean by the history of philosophy, and what are the political circumstances that led to the formation of this kind of canon that we take to be absolute, final, and necessary. The emphasis is on its necessity. So let me stop here. I can say, of course, a great deal more about that, but I think we'll do that as we go along.
Okay. Yes. To pick up on what you were just saying, in the introduction of the book, indeed, in the first sentence, you say that your quote aim is quite literally to undo the past, both its pastness and its necessity. Unquote. And so part of what you're trying to do, in my understanding of your book, is to undo misreadings of thinkers like Aristotle, Spinoza, Marx, Benjamin, and Adorno. In fact, you argue that philosophers like Kant and Hegel have participated in what you consider to be an occlusion of a materialist philosophical tradition that stretches from Aristotle to the present through the thinkers that I've just mentioned, and that to some degree many of these thinkers, with which I presume we can accept Aristotle, have been marginalized from mainstream philosophical tradition. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about this materialist tradition that you raise. What are its Aristotelian elements? How were those elements transmitted to Spinoza? And what are some of the factors that have kept it on the margins?
Let me refine some things.
And
we'll begin with Aristotle, because not just Aristotle, but the Plato that we have now taken into the canon have been baptized. The very condition was baptism. Let us not forget the condemnation of 1272, 1277, and 1311 of Thomas's works in the wake of the Averroes controversy. In other words, the Aristotle that eventually made its way through the canon is not Aristotle. It's not Aristotle. Now, I'll get back to that. To that other tradition, because in many ways, as I said earlier, this is this book interrupted another. It's not that it was not always on the horizon, but another project that involves Maimonides, Gersonides, and Spinoza specifically, as heirs to that other Aristotelian tradition, and as having profound influence on Spinoza. Now. Let me take a brief. Immediately, I can see somebody saying, but Spinoza criticized Maimonides. Of course he did. In other words, he criticized Descartes, but that does not prevent us from seeing the importance of the critical engagement with Descartes for Spinoza's own project. And where Spinoza sometimes is quite disingenuous in his criticism of Maimonides, and presents actually at a couple of places in the TTP, Tractatus Theologico-Politicus.
Yes, thank you.
he presents as something, as a Pauline saying, something that is straightforward Maimonides. Anyway, but this is not the time for it. So, I mean, I'll say more about it now. The first thing I want to say, so in undoing the past, but I want to insist, it has two dimensions. It's not just that. The past is not past. The past is very much, is alive, as symptoms of the present, as symptoms in the present. We cannot forget that. In other words, the past is, first of all, has a material, concrete, bodily effects. That it's a psychic wound to the present. That's the problem. That is why remembrance, for me, is so absolutely essential. Not to allow the past to become finally past. I think probably the most important essay that I know on that short, and well, short is a relative term, is by Adorno, entitled, it was given as a radio address, entitled The Meaning of Working Through the Past, and the problem of the assumption that indeed we can work through the past and put it
It
exactly in the past, get over it, and forget it. That for Adorno is, that's a mark of Mephistopheles, Now it is over, what meaning can there be, The Faust, I'm quoting Faust, but the whole point is, no, it's not past. The assumption that it is past only allows it to continue to foster in the present, and exercise very serious political, material political forces that remain invisible. The problem is precisely the assumption that indeed we are over the past, the assumption that Auschwitz is really past, allows the conditions that made Auschwitz possible to continue. That to me is why what is at stake here is a lot more than just a number of thinkers. Yes, indeed, I'm a philosopher. I care very much about those thinkers. I talk to them all the time. And no, I'm not schizophrenic and I don't hear voices. I talk to a lot of dead men. And yes, they are men. And yes, I'm a feminist, but that does not change the fact that they are men. There were no women philosophers. But the whole point is, very seriously, is that there is a great deal at stake here for me politically and philosophically. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's at both dimensions, and the two, I resist any attempt to separate them, mm-hmm. because that very tradition of which I speak was repressed by ecclesiastical political decree. Mm. Okay. And what was at stake was, guess what? A book I adore called The De Anima, okay? Or Aristotle's commentary on The De Anima in particular. And that, and Averroes says, and the claim, the biggest issue was two things that were accusation in particular, but it was on the unity of the intellect against it, on the question of human immortality, on an Averroes or a materialist Aristotelian tradition. Mm-hmm. You cannot have individual immortality. So the individual, key mm-hmm. here is individual immortality. Mm-hmm. And individual immortality would make no sense. No sense whatsoever. Because to the extent that anything is immortal, it is knowledge. Hmm. And knowledge, if it is true knowledge, does not differ between you and I. Hmm. Saddam Hussein and Bush did not disagree about mathematical truth. Those are certain. Hmm. Those are unchanging. They're eternal in that sense. They're immortal. Okay. I mean, you don't disagree about, you know, the sum of the angles of a triangle. What you disagree about is good and bad, beautiful and ugly. In other words, all normative categories. Hmm. So, to this tradition, individual immortality makes no sense whatsoever. Mm. None. Mm. None at all. That is precisely anathema. Mm. Anathema to Christianity for a variety of reasons. Now, the interesting thing is that, I'm giving an aside from the book, but it really is behind it, is that Thomas, in a text entitled On the Unity of the Intellect Against the Averroists, the Unitate Intellectus, anyway, doesn't matter, Intellectu contra Averroistas, says, philosophically, it doesn't matter. He is fully aware of the fact that it's not a philosophical question. Hmm. Philosophically, it really doesn't make sense. But that means that in order to allow Aristotle into the Western canon, Aristotle has to be seriously baptized. Hmm. That's also true of Plato. That's also true of Plato. Mm-hmm. I mean, the moment of the final baptism of Plato occurs in Ficino. Yeah, where he says the soul is the whole man, about the Symposium, the most embodied of all texts. Mm-hmm. Okay? The most erotic and embodied of all texts.
Right.
Okay, so in other words, the very condition of the transmission into the West and what becomes the history of philosophy, the canon, the Western canon, okay, the history of the West, or the Western canon, is already determined completely by ecclesiastical, political, or theological political forces, which is, again, why the critique of religion? That's precisely the moment of the intervention, and it's an intervention in critical theory or in a particular form of political philosophy today. Now, that to me there's nothing abstract here for me, okay? It's it's concrete, and it material, and it continues. In other words, it's not then. Mm-hmm. It continues. In other words, like just a few consequences, okay? Basically, the notion of free will, as we'll see when we get to Spinoza and the critique of religion, it does not exist in Aristotle. It does not exist in Plato. It makes no sense. The will is never free. Mm. Incidentally, the will is never free for Augustine either. Choice is free. Mm. It's liberum arbitrium. Okay, arbitrium, not voluntas. Voluntas is never free. Okay. Choice is free. Very different thing. The will, okay, as free, is a result of the story of the fall, which nowhere exists in the Jewish tradition or in the Islamic tradition, the fall.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Right.
In other words, because what happens as a consequence is a split, literally a split between all appetites, desire on the one hand, and will. Desire is seen as base, okay? Mm-hmm. As base. Mm-hmm. Will is something else. Will is the capacity to choose God over base desires. I mean, doesn't matter, we can go back to Paul, to Romans 10. Mm-hmm. Well, depends how you count the books, but it's, I see another law in my members, or later on to Augustine. But even in Augustine, we don't have substance dualism. We don't get to substance dualism until we get to, in philosophy, until we get to Descartes. And in some ways, you can say in theology already with Luther, Sulfidianism and sola scriptura.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the removal of a mediation by the ecclesia.
The community.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So there's a great deal that can be said here. And in many ways, you can't write this story without also knowing theology, clearly. and the real differences, theological differences, because it is... There is no such thing as history that is not theological political. That is not theological political. That's always the case. It's not something political history is ecclesiastical political history. You can go all the way. Even controversies that we never think about as what do they have to do with theology? The nominalist realist controversy, universal's real. They go back to what can we predicate the same thing of God and of humans. Not abstract. For them, not abstract at all. And it survives, that controversy survives today, of course, without knowing.
Exactly.
And to me, this is what really needs to be really brought back into the surface, into relief, and engage critically. We have lost it. In that sense, we have lost the capacity for a certain form of materialist critique. Now, once we get to Descartes, dualism. In other words, the materialist tradition disappears. It's not that it is marginalized. To the extent that it is then allowed back in, it is distorted. So, what's the history? The differences? The commentators, I'm just giving you a line of transmission.
Sure.
The commentaries, in particular, let's use just the De Anima, but it's not just the De Anima, okay? Because we forget that the De Anima cannot be separated from the Nicomachean Ethics. They belong together. The question of desire is central to both. Absolutely. The De Anima ends with the question of desire, and the Nicomachean Ethics says that human being is a desiring intellect. Or thinking desire, not desire and intellect, but desiring intellect, bodily, material. Thinking is already desirative. It's not indifferent. Thinking is active and thinking is desirative. Now, the movement is basically from the first Aristotelian chair, if you want to call it, is Alexander of Aphrodisias, after that Themistius, in particular. I'm talking now about the thinkers I'm focusing on. Alexander, Themistius, and then for me, Al-Farabi, Averroes, Maimonides, Gersonides. And even though Gersonides does not read Arabic, he's in this Judeo-Arabic tradition and writes super commentaries on all of Aristotle's, Averroes' commentaries on Aristotle, which is why I also have those minor biological writings. Now, one of the things which is really interesting, when I'm returning to the other research, we don't have his commentary on the metaphysics is not extant, or if it is, it's not at the place that we can reach it. There's still a lot of manuscripts in Russia, in certain Arab countries, etc., that we have no access to. So all of us have been looking for the lost metaphysics, but there are enough references to more or less piece together his position. But it's not just that. And I discovered the Nicomachean Ethics was nowhere to be seen, and I could not understand why. I discovered it. It is in his commentary on Ecclesiastes, the most heretical. But that's this project that I left on and I will come back. And of course, I'm going back to it right now. I already started last summer the summer before in Jerusalem. But the whole point, this is the transmission. Now, that Maimonides had profound impact on on Spinoza, everybody knows, everybody thinks that it is negative, that is false, that is simply false, it's bad reading. We are not careful readers.
Hmm.
I tell my students, and I want to teach you how to read slowly, very slowly, as in Munich, as in music, lente, lentamente, make haste slowly. That to me is key. We are bad readers.
Hmm.
We don't have time. I mean, we live in the age of bit information. That is why it is urgent now, especially urgent. Critical thinking, we are losing every capacity for critical thinking.
Mm.
So to me, again, this is not abstract.
Mm-hmm.
It's really concrete. So, and Gersonides, most people have not even heard of him.
Mm.
Well, anyone who has done any work in astronomy would know his name. He had an important influence on Kepler and on Copernicus. He was also a mathematician, did some very interesting work on Euclid's, on Euclidean geometry. Spinoza does not speak of him, except, okay, he appears once in a key moment where Spinoza refers to him, where he disagrees with something, at the TTP, Tractatus Theologica Politicus, and he says, a man otherwise the most erudite. Okay, superlative.
Mm.
The most erudite. That's the highest praise you ever see for a thinker in Spinoza.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. Ibn Ezra, whom he highly esteems, he says, very erudite, but not the superlative.
Mm.
Okay. That he had influence, I've written a lot on it, on that influence, especially on the issue of the question of knowledge, intellect, etc. So in other words, it's not that I come here without, but that's another tradition, and a tradition that literally is not accessible, is not available.
Hmm.
Most people have not even heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we go to my friends Kant and Hegel.
Hegel. Your friends.
Well, actually, the truth of the matter is Kant is a philosopher I love to hate.
Hmm.
I mean, he's brilliant. And he's also a thorough and complete anti-Jewish.
Hmm.
And as I make, I'm at pains to point out, we should not confuse anti-Judaism with anti-Semitism. They are not the same. And again, the rise of anti-Judaism now makes this work all the more urgent again.
Mm-hmm.
And the enlisting of all sorts of theological, political sentiments. Now, but in the case of Hegel in particular, Hegel knows who Maimonides is, but he becomes completely repressed. He had Maimonides' guide in Latin translation on his shelf, and he completely mispresents him.
Hmm.
He even mispresents where he was born. In other words, his place of birth and his place of death. He confuses them. But he also presents him as a mutakalim. Okay? And Maimonides could not be more critical of the mutakalimun, okay, of the dialectical theologian, than anyone. And he presents his position as a member of the Mutakalimun. Not just that, Hegel, even though Hegel says, Hegel together with Schelling and Hölderlin, if you want to philosophize, you must Spinozize first.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, okay, and claims to be Spinoza plus time, nonetheless, he excludes Spinoza, okay, absolutely, from the Western canon, okay, or from, excludes Spinoza philosophy, okay, claiming that it consigns it to the Orient, the place where only one is free. Okay, in other words, and in both cases, what's at stake, both Kant and Hegel, is Judaism. Judaism is the religion of unfreedom, and in that sense, for Kant, it is not even a religion. It is not even a religion. Okay, in other words, it's precisely the issue of autonomy and heteronomy, but clearly we can't go into it, the philosophical meat here, but a lot is at stake here. But that's why these are the people who are seen as Spinoza's heirs. And against that, I'm bringing Marx, Benjamin, and Adorno as Spinoza's heirs. Now, there are two others, but this is already a
this formidable
it will have required a lot more. The other two, who are in two different ways, one is Freud. Freud is here in the notes very often, and in the notes, especially when we get to Adorno, that's and when I'm talking about repression, but and also Nietzsche. But Nietzsche in a very different form. But Nietzsche actually writes to Franz Overbeck in July 31, 1881. He writes, "I have a predecessor, and what a predecessor!" Okay, the only thing that separates us are 200 years, and the things in which, and all the things which he singles out, in which Spinoza is his predecessor, the critique of teleology, the critique of free will, and all the normative categories, good and bad, beautiful and ugly, etc., etc. In other words, fully and completely. And that's the moment when Nietzsche returns to a lot of his moral writings. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about Daybreak or we're talking about the gay science. Again, the reference is to Spinoza. The gay science, or we're talking Beyond Good and Evil, etc., etc. It's, you can see the Spinoza's influence in some very important ways. But clearly, Nietzsche certainly has no place in this particular book. Freud would have just made it formidable. I mean, really formidable. And it already is demanding to the reader. I'm not easy on the reader. I know that. But that too is deliberate. As I say, intelligibility to everyone is not a criterion for truth. And that to me is very important, because that's the issue in terms of what will be at stake in critical theory. So I hope I answered this particular question in sufficient detail.
yes, thank you. And you know, as you have noted, and as I will note, we're not going to be able to cover the book
in
detail, and I leave it to the listener to pick up a copy and work through it.
Yeah, what we especially would not, if I may interject, be able to cover with any adequacy is the relation between, first of all, the the impact of Marx on the impact of Spinoza on Marx, fully I can say some things about it, but especially of Marx on Benjamin and Adorno, and the very fecund relation between them, that too is distorted. But
And we'll hopefully learn a little bit about that.
I hope so,
But first, if you could talk about Spinoza's critique of religion. Again, a huge thing to talk about, but how was it formulated, and how was Marx influenced by it?
Okay, let me start, I guess, with, I can't talk about how it was formulated. I can tell you what the essential elements of it are. Already as early as the, now very often, okay, let me take an aside. Spinoza's ethics is read as a metaphysics, not as an ethics. Very strange phenomenon. Why is the ethics is an ethics. Now, sorry.
It's all right.
Already in the appendix to part one of the ethics, Spinoza, the critique of religion, comes in the most intense way, precisely against the metaphysicians and the theologians. Okay. And the two things, teleology is radically criticized, and the will of God, which he says the sanctuary of ignorance. And he means that in a double way. Okay, the sanctuary of ignorance. It both preserves it and it saves it. Okay. In other words. And that to him is key. Why, what is it? The very question is, and the attribution we begin with the issue of free will, and the issue is we are conscious of our appetites, but unconscious of the causes of the appetites. Okay, so we assume ourselves to be free agents, where indeed we are not. We are acting in ignorance. Now, for him, the teleology, teleology specifically, and free will, and especially free God is willing, okay, is not just, those are not just prejudices. They have turned into deeply entrenched superstitions that are safeguarded, not just that, promoted by theologians and metaphysicians. And anyone who questions, who seeks to inquire into nature, okay, into nature as, okay, is denounced as a heretic. So from the very beginning, Spinoza shows you, okay, that the very questioning, okay, the very question of science, the very question of knowledge is already a theological, political question from the very beginning. And this occurs at the end of book one of the Ethics. Okay. Book three, four, and five of the Ethics are all about the affects. All about the affects, passion. Mm-hmm. And for Spinoza, the theological, political affects par excellence are hope and fear. Mm. Hope and fear. Fear is necessary for the self-preservation of the animal. Hope is the condition for flourishing. If you look at every election in the U.S., hope and fear is what is being mongered. Bush was all about fear. Obama talks about the audacity of hope. Mm. The language that is continuously deployed is a religious language. It's a theological, political language. And hope and fear, okay, a species of hope and fear are love and hate. Mm. That this is not a minor issue. This is precisely the question of the psychology and mass psychology that will become absolutely essential. And Spinoza is the first one to be able to really theorize mass psychology. Brilliant analysis of the masses. The masses as a force. Machiavelli mentions it in The Prince, okay, that the tyrant has most to fear, which is why the tyrant is so repressive. He has to be more and more repressive because he's got more and more to fear. But Spinoza theorizes it already. So the very question, the ethics is an ethics and a physics. It's precisely. Okay, if mind, Spinoza says, is nothing but an idea of body, it's not that it has an idea of body, it is bodily. Okay. Then indeed, the control of mind, the control of hope and fear is the most powerful tool, political, theological, political tool, and much more can be said about it. So the work, the whole work, okay, and then we go to the TTP, and again, how do we begin? Prejudice. Okay. Prejudice. But so when Spinoza asks the question of the psychology of the affect, okay, the question is, there's never an assumption. It would be foolish to assume, okay, that religion, the question is, already in the appendix to part one, what he tries to understand is, why is religion a need? Fear is a huge dimension, has a huge dimension here. Religion is a need. There's never an assumption. Precisely, if mind is nothing but an idea of body, that reason has no control over the affect. That's a conceit of the philosophers. That's a conceit of dualism. Okay. And the people say, well, isn't he influenced by the Stoics? He ridicules them in the preface to part five, precisely on this issue. Reason has no power over the affects, definitely not hope and fear. And you don't want it to have. It's necessary for self-preservation. If you did not fear, you'll die. So the point is, there's nothing, but the whole point is, the more we understand that, the more we can begin to ask, when's freedom, how freedom, what is possible. But definitely, we do not valorize reason in the wrong way. This is not anti-reason, okay, on the contrary. But we have to understand the limits of reason, which is something that I've always been engaged in many ways. I don't know if you know, but my first book is entitled Maimonides and Aquinas on the Limits of Reason. Precisely the limits of the issue is not, it's not against reason. Okay, I want more critical thinking. But what do we mean by reason? What do we mean, especially in the public sphere? Etc., etc. So, and especially, I think the more we understand the psychology of the affects, the more we can be politically critical in the right ways. So that's sort of, how did it influence Marx? Okay, that's
another
puzzle that I uncovered. I love uncovering things. That's why I like really good mysteries. There is a text entitled Spinoza's Theologische Politische Traktat von Karl Heinrich Marx, Berlin, 1841. It is buried in plain sight in the Mega, Marx Engels Gesamtausgabe in volume 4. It's in 3 notebooks. Okay? And it's in Latin.
Wow.
With some small marginal comments in German. Huh. And it is almost entirely unknown. It is mentioned by Steve Smith once in passing, nothing about it. It is mentioned by Yirmiyahu Yovel on Spinoza and Other Heretics. But it's never not analyzed. There are 3 essays devoted to it, two really, in a volume of Cahiers Spinoza 1. That's basically, it reproduces the text in the Latin, and it has a French translation. And then there are 2 articles, one by Alexander Materon and one by Rubel. Now, that's it. Okay? I take issue with Materon. I have tremendous respect for Alexander Materon, but I take issue with the way he reads it, but it's not for here. This is already nitty-gritty, in other words, a philosophical detail. But in Rubel. But that's it. No one has done work on it. What happens in that text is Marx takes the TTP and rearranges it, and through ellipses, omissions, additions, changes, and ellipses, intensifies certain aspects of the text, okay? Brings into relief what is really at stake. What he does in addition to that, I'll say a couple of things, he also appends to that 25 letters. 25 letters, some on some very important on definitions, very important the status of definitions in Spinoza, and some, a lot of them on science, and some on, and it is bookended by a critique of, by 2 letters that are incredibly critical of theologians. Okay. Now, what he emphasizes again and again, okay, what Marx focuses on, first of all, that nature creates individuals, not nations, which are distinguished into nations by prejudices, customs, and laws. Okay. It occurs in 2 places in the TTP, and Marx emphasizes it. It intensifies it precisely through ellipses, intensifies it. Okay. And in addition to that, he's especially interested in the Hebrew Commonwealth. Because the question is, what counts for the superiority, for the election of the Jews? Okay. And the point is, what is the superiority? The laws. Okay. The laws and what is it? Absolute equality. Okay. One, the Jews, in many ways, the Jews were not elected. The Jews elected God. Okay, they are subject to no human. Okay, they are subject to no human, and 2, there's absolute equality. So even if somebody has to alienate their property at one point, in the Jubilee years, it would be returned to them. In other words, absolute economic equality, and subject to no human. Okay, in other words, the superiority is the laws, and in other words, in the Hebrew Commonwealth, the perfect theocracy was a perfect democracy. It's a paradox and a very important one. And Marx is especially interested in it, precisely. And what is it? It resembles the democratic form of government is the most natural, resembles the natural most thoroughly, which was something that we will return to in Marx later on. Okay. So in other words, and this is the 3 notebooks precede, okay? The Marx's 3 notebooks precede all of his, the critique of religion, sort of his letter to Rouge, his critique of Bruno Bauer, the Jewish question, the two forms of the Jewish question, can the Jew be emancipated, it precedes it. And again, the critique that Marx affects them, people find it very repulsive, but that's because they don't know how to read. Marx, again, in the Bruno Bauer text, intensifies, okay, Bauer's claim, brings into relief precisely how repulsive they are. Okay, and he also says quite explicitly, so long as Bauer's criticism remains theological, they remain critical. The minute, okay, that they cease being theological, they're uncritical. So you see the same movement, the same approach to critical, material, concrete, the text, okay? Not something outside the text, but indeed it's a concrete material and it intensifies the claims to bring into relief precisely what is in question. Mm-hmm. That's how he moves there, and the same thing will happen in the Feuerbach. But again, one of the things that I seek to do is indeed also show that for Marx, first of all, there is no difference in kind between the critique of religion and critique of ideology, precisely because, following Spinoza, mind is nothing but an idea of body, or in Marx's idiom, which is the same, okay, consciousness, okay, be it false or true, is nothing but an expression, okay, of the oppressive institutions of which it is the expression, the material, the concrete institutions. Okay. That's precisely what consciousness reflects. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the movement, it is thoroughly Spinozian. I don't want to say Spinozist. I want to, in the same as I distinguish between Marxist and Marxian for the same reason. It is attentive to Spinoza, but that and furthermore, precisely, you begin from forms of consciousness and then move the critique of political economy. They are not different in kind. Mm-hmm. They're not different in kind. You see that because that is immediately followed by his critique of Hegel's philosophy of right that brings in both dimension into view and goes all the way through to Capital. So, and there again, he says, democracy is the most perfect form of the state. Okay, but also there in the introduction to Hegel's philosophy of right, he says the critique of religion is the archy of critiques. It's the exemplary, the archy, the original, the originary critique. Okay, this is Marx. This is Marx. This is not just Dobbs Weinstein inserting something into Marx. Mm-hmm. It's there. But as I say, we don't read, or we read very selectively. Mm. And so a part of this too is a part of a whole project of retrieving.
Right.
So that's sort of much more can be said clearly about the critique of religion. But I mean, in many ways, one can be a theologian and be a critic of religion or a philosopher of religion. Mm-hmm. What does Maimonides do? Mm. That's what Maimonides does throughout. So the critique, again, the assumption is not assuming that one can overcome religion.
Right.
The other thing that we really must distinguish, and most people don't, not even in the academy, is between religion and theology. Theology properly understood is a science. Religion is something else. It's a speculative science, but it's a science. Traditionally, I'm talking for Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
Go to the Summa. Okay, he's quite explicit about it. But that's, and generally seats or chairs in theology are speculative theology. That's generally in places where you have chairs in theology. But don't confuse our divinity schools here. I'm thinking of the European model.
Sure.
So let us not confuse religion.
Okay.
Religion as a... Yes, as a mode of deploying and manipulating hope and fear. And that's the theological political is the religious here. And theology, which is something entirely different. I mean, you can ask why God became man, okay, but that's a different issue. mm-hmm. altogether. Mm-hmm. Now, it has a political dimension,
sure,
incidentally.
Sure.
of course it has a political dimension. The very difference is a question between particularity and universality and the very possibility of salvation. I mean, I'm referring here specifically to St. Anselm, to the text, Cur Deus Homo, Why God Became Man. Mm-hmm. But so we shouldn't confuse them at all. And what we do in the academy is something else again. is something else again. In other words, one can be a professor of religion mm-hmm. and be a thoroughgoing unbeliever.
right.
So it's not about belief.
Right.
Again, the academic profession is not about belief. It's you investigate. Now, you may also be a believer, but
right.
but those the two should not be confused.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah.
okay. Hopefully,
I
answered it adequately.
Well, now we're kind of just moving along mm-hmm. With your book, and we've been talking about Spinoza, and the main title of the book mentions Spinoza alone, and is of course, as you've just discussed, central to the. To what you say in the book, but you consider the project actually to be quote an intervention strictly situated in the project of critical theory,
mm-hmm.
rather than in the reception history of Spinoza.
Indeed,
unquote. So, what is the project of critical theory,
okay.
and how has it taken up this okay. this critique in Spinoza and in Marx?
Okay.
And that's a huge question.
Yeah,
but.
It's huge, and I would not be able to answer it adequately, but let me try. First of all, it is not a reception history. While, as
mm-hmm.
I say, the book is definitely haunted by history,
mm-hmm.
it's not a reception history. That's not its intention at all. And there's some very good works that do that job. But really what's at stake right now is when I say whose philosophy, which politics, or whose history, it's also what do we mean by critical theory? And in many ways, I end the book quite explicitly and continue in the project of the book is why Adorno now?
Mm-hmm.
To me, why Adorno now is centrally? Because generally it is thought, Benjamin is not even fully included in critical theory, somewhere on the margin. And he's adopted by in some really amazing ways, against which I'm very critical,
mm.
clearly in the book, but very often Adorno has okay. I cannot think of no thinker who has had more spite directed at him. Okay, and it occurs at various levels. Okay. Now, I also can think of no thinker who is a more thorough materialist negative dialectician than anyone else. I think that what's at stake in critical theory for me, especially now, is indeed what do we mean by critical theory and what is its place, even how can it intervene? Okay. So the issue, it begins with, and generally, so no, Spinoza has been, he's a Mandarin, okay. Spinoza favors theory of a practice. Spinoza has no interest in practice. I mean, the whole exchange with the students during the and especially with Bader, etc., who was a student.
Hmm.
I mean, in Frankfurt it was a horrible episodes, etc. You are our guru, you are not... It was really a very ugly, very, very ugly scenes, and he was denounced again, again, again. He and Horkheimer. But now this, what's especially ironic about that this continues, is that from the time he returned to Frankfurt, he gave, and everybody knew Adorno, he gave weekly radio addresses.
Hmm.
Very important, like the meaning of working through the past, education after Auschwitz, why still philosophy, etc. Those are public lectures.
Mm-hmm.
If that's our political intervention, I don't know what is, but
mm-hmm.
let's leave that aside for a moment. We probably will come back to it. But the whole point is, no, he's been... So the alternatives that we've given to Adorno are later generation critical theorists, in particular Habermas.
Mm-hmm.
And now that Habermas and after Habermas, Honneth, Axel Honneth, etc. Now, it is against that that this is an intervention. Okay. In my view, they're not critical theorists, not in that sense, in a materialist sense,
mm-hmm.
Of which I'm speaking now. And also I think that politically, Adorno gives us with tools, critical tools, that are by far more important. Okay, rather than speak about rational competence, okay, he shows us precisely the problem and the very question. The question that already begins with Benjamin. The problem for us is the very possibility of experience. The very possibility of experience. Okay? Because experience is the very condition for critical self-consciousness.
Hmm.
And that is missing, totally missing. Now, the other dimensions to it, in a minute I'll come to it, but the whole point is, so the question is Adorno or, okay? Now, in addition, in the US in particular, all of a sudden, Arendt is presented as a critical theorist. And Arendt is not a critical theorist. Arendt is not even a philosopher. She's not even a good historian. She quotes Nazi sources. I don't want to go into, as you know, I bracketed it at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to go into it, but since she's taken up as a critical theorist, I don't want to engage her directly because she's not a critical theorist. She's explicitly not a critical theorist. And so I had to deal with her very reluctantly. Habermas I take on throughout the book
mm-hmm.
because Habermas is a critical mm-hmm. theorist and Habermas is really the important presentation of an alternative in critical theory.
Hmm.
And it is very much against that that I engage also the Benjamin Adorno relation in relation to Habermas, okay, and critically in relation to Habermas from the very beginning. And from the very beginning, the minute I get negative dialectics as a Jewish or secular
right.
negative theology, species of negative theology. I'm using the word species there clearly. Species, as in Spinoza, okay, aspect. Okay, but specifically asking what is negative dialectics?
Mm.
The book,
mm-hmm.
as well as the practice of critique. So that's what for me is at stake in what is critical theory and how do we and who has the power, at least perhaps supply us with the tools to intervene now, if at all possible. If at all possible.
Hmm.
You're
not terribly optimistic.
Oh, far from it, actually. I'll later on perhaps we'll talk about,
yeah.
not at all, not
yeah.
at all. Not in the age of what I call bit information and sham revolutions.
Hmm.
So, no, not at all.
Hmm.
But that's why it is all the more important to insist on critical self-reflection to the extent at all possible.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, again, false clarity is another name for myth.
Mm.
That to me is Habermas. Okay. Okay. So either engaging thinkers like Rawls and really completely changing what critical theory is all about, or the assumption that we can accommodate religion on the one hand, or for that matter, as in Honneth, engaging phenomenology. No, it is either phenomenology or politics.
Hmm.
Even, I mean, Adorno, you can't reconcile Adorno and Heidegger, let alone, there's attempt, Adorno and even Merleau-Ponty, etc. They're really they're two very different projects.
Mm-hmm.
And you can even call it critical phenomenology. It's still not critical theory in the sense that I mean
right.
In the sense that I mean it here, what do we mean by critical theory specifically? And to me, it's precisely that materialist concrete critique. Okay? Because all of those movements are movements away from history and politics, even though they claim not to be.
Hmm.
Even though they claim not to be. Hmm. So there's a great deal at stake here for me.
Right.
And I don't think I never try to cover it over.
right.
So I hope I...
Yes. and we'll this next question gets a little bit more into the relationship between Benjamin and Adorno.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, I wanted you to address the discussion or the concept or the, know what to call it exactly, but the two Jewish prohibitions that you bring up, and those are, to quote you, the prohibition against preparation for the Messianic age, which is at the heart of Benjamin and Adorno's critique of teleology, especially the teleological orientation of politics, and the prohibition against graven images, which is at the heart of their political critique of mimesis, unquote. So could you talk more about what you mean by these prohibitions and how they function in the critique of religion, and how Benjamin and Adorno appropriated them?
There are several trajectories which I can take, but given that you have started me with the question of the prohibitions, we'll go from the prohibitions first. Now, we have to understand it, my emphasis on the prohibition specifically in how we're going to understand negative dialectics, because that's exactly the context in which I work it, is to emphasize that that has to be understood also in the context of the attempts, okay, to see Benjamin and Adorno as radically at odds about a great deal, and taking it to a particular very important correspondence, I'll say some things about it. But let's start with the prohibitions. I emphasize hope and fear earlier, and I emphasize it again and again, because they are to say that they're theological, political forces par excellence. It's also to say that they're future-oriented. In other words, it's purely future-oriented. The future orientation of history and politics is thoroughly Augustinian. Okay, in other words, belongs to a particular philosophy of history, initially theology of history, and then transformed into, once God becomes an emigre, into a philosophy of history. Okay, and but that sees well-being, salvation, however you want to see it, okay, salus, there's always a future orientation, and it's always a orientation away from bodies, okay, always, okay. In other words, freedom is indeed freedom, which is the very condition of salvation, etc. And knowledge is a progressive movement away from bodies and politics, okay. Freedom is indeed, okay. So the realm of nature is really the realm of necessity, the realm of unfreedom, okay. Mm. The realm of the Jewish law, the law of the members, as opposed to the future orientation, salvation in the future. And later on we'll get it. The peculiar thing is that we have it in Kant, we have it in Hegel, etc. In Kant, of course, we have it. It presents a huge problem, because once efficient causality becomes a mechanical causality, you can't reconcile, okay, atomistic mechanical causality with final causality, so we get a deus ex machina, okay? In other words, the chiliastic, that's why Kant says, nothing empirical would convince me otherwise, okay? The empirical is vulgar. In other words, it is willing that future orientation, okay? The future orientation of history and politics, okay, is willing to sacrifice each and every human being for the sake of future humanity, or for the sake to sacrifice the present for the sake of future generations. You hear that rhetoric all the time around you here, okay, all the time. Rather than take care of the poor, okay, we won't go into debt so that our grandchildren, my responsibility is here and now to the poor. Precisely in the light, okay, of oppressed ancestors, okay. So from the very beginning, for Judaism, that's key. The prohibition against the preparation of the Messianic age is not extrinsic; it's absolutely intrinsic to Judaism, and that disappears the minute you read Benjamin is a Kabbalist. Like you go, excuse me, or you read Adorno, there's a difference between utopia and a utopian moment in thinking. Not the same thing. It's absolutely anti-utopian. Okay. Because, again, it's willing to sacrifice human beings now for the sake of humanity. So that prohibition is central. It is central to Benjamin, and it has profound influence also on Adorno, especially the movement, too, the more he becomes engaged with the question of politics and repression. Now, the prohibition against graven image, likewise, again, it is appropriated. It is read as if it is the it's read in the context of a negative theology of a, you know, Western negative theology, be it of Dionysus, be it of even Thomas, etc. But no, the prohibition here is on making graven images. Okay, making graven images, false deity. They require human sacrifice. And for Adorno, and for Benjamin, but for Adorno especially, he closes his essay on Benjamin, one of his essays on Benjamin. There has got to be a human estate that requires no human sacrifice. That to me is key, and that is key to understanding the centrality of these two prohibitions to their understanding of history and politics, and in that relation, politics and art, specifically. That's why I did not expect art to become so central, and especially music, to become so central. But it books write me. I don't. In other words, it demanded it. In other words, precisely on the question of image, and a sound is still an image. So, but that particular exchange is absolutely central, and half of Adorno's writings are in music. So there's a great deal, and they are appropriated. There's something absolutely preposterous about the way in which they are appropriated into a certain kind of Kabbalist tradition. First of all, Kabbalah, all you need to... Now, first of all, indeed, Benjamin was in correspondence and was friends with Scholem, but Scholem was not a Kabbalist. He was the foremost student of Kabbalah. But it doesn't make him a Kabbalist. I'm not a Thomist, and I've worked extensively on Thomas Aquinas. And he's, but I'm not a Thomist. In other words, the fact that you're a foremost student of something does, on the contrary. And if there's one thing that Scholem is at pains to show is the millenarian influences on Kabbalah. Precisely it's millenarian, which is to say Christian millenarian movements on Kabbalah. It's not Jewish. Okay. In other words, again, that kind of orientation is not that it's precisely at the moment at which, well, the eschaton did not happen. But to read him, and Habermas loves reading him, and there's something absolutely offensive about that association, because what is forgotten, excuse me, who are his interlocutors? They're all great Jewish philosophers and writers. Okay, we're not talking about Kabbalah. Okay, we're talking about I mean, really, we're talking not to mention that the foremost philosopher of the early part of the 20th century in Germany at the time is Solomon Maimon, who wrote with Maimonides. Okay, über die Lehre Spinoza, on Spinoza too. Über die Lehre Spinoza and the Ethics of Maimonides, etc., etc. In other words, no, that über die Lehre Spinoza is Hegel, but on Spinoza, on Maimonides' Ethics, etc. In other words, you're dealing here with all of their friends. They're all philosophers and important philosophers, composers, okay, literary figures. Mann, for instance, and all of that is bracketed away, and all of a sudden, seeing them in light of Shabtai Tzvi, who is the false, who is the false Messiah. I mean, there's something absolutely preposterous about the forceful distortion of that aspect, and that is key to understanding the critical engagement. Now, that the thesis on the concept of history have profound influence on Adorno, I think, is hard to miss. You really, again, have to deliberately misread. But there's, so everything, the antagonism supposedly between them is based upon a series of letters about what eventually becomes the Arcades Project, but also becomes a separate study on Baudelaire. And It is an exchange between philosophical friends.
Hmm.
Letter writing cannot be, okay. They invite criticism. They critically engage one another. And indeed, at the end, Benjamin too recognizes even those who were sort of not very happy with Adorno for withholding publication of Part 2. Because he said, it's not worthy of you. This is your magnum opus. It has to be at least of the same stature as the Trauerspiele, okay, his great Baroque, the study of Baroque, a tragic drama, and indeed, eventually, when Benjamin himself admits that it greatly improved the work, and when Adorno receives the final version, I mean, normally you don't get expressions of glee, but it's like a midwife is so happy with the final version. So there's a complete misunderstanding of the critical exchange in letters.
Hmm.
And that is so important here. Again, we don't know how to read the difference. Philosophical engagement, what occurs in letters, is different than what occurs in text. Or, for that matter, we have to be able to tell the difference between a preface, an apology,
mm-hmm.
and a book.
Mm-hmm.
And letters and a book. I mean, I call these prefaces, appendices, notes attached, and letters in particular, extravagantes. It's a term I borrow from the medieval legal tradition, where you have interlinear glosses and marginal glosses, and when they run out of space, they write separate commentaries, okay, reflecting on the text, and they're extravagantes because they walk around, extravagant, walk around the text, but outside, they don't suffer the same constraint. And this is an exchange, okay, and a very important critical exchange. So I take those letters very, very seriously, but not negatively. That's the whole point. And everybody tries to rescue Benjamin from Adorno, including Heidegger. He says, this is a tender critique, it's not, okay. And a lot is at stake there.
Hmm.
A lot is at stake there between the two very different project, again, Habermas and Adorno, but also in relation to Benjamin in particular.
Right.
Everybody wants to claim Benjamin as the sole friend. Everybody. I mean, it's quite fantastic. And as I call it, it's sort of a very promiscuous man.
That's
but,
right.
Yeah, but it's a very important correspondence, and it's either, in other words, negative dialectics is read, but to me, some of the most important works are not read, and especially that very fecund exchange between them, and it's not by accident that it is to Adorno that Benjamin entrusts his Nachlass. Adorno in Scholem, but specifically the last, the suitcase that he had with him was to be taken to Adorno, not to Arendt.
Right,
so it's, again, makes this horrific claim that he tries to suppress. Excuse me, he brought the Adorno's work to light. Benjamin's work to light, So again, there, all of this, I mean, that's why I say spite really characterizes, I'm quoting Dutmann here, spite characterizes the responses to Adorno, and were the students riots revolutionary? No. There's a difference, and that's absolutely essential in reading the exchange, and especially how the surrealist art comes into it. Okay, the difference between revolt and revolution is enormous, absolutely enormous, and makes all the difference. Okay? Because revolt can be indeed enlisted, can become regressive. Revolt can become regressive. It's not, there was nothing revolutionary to the students' movement. Now, is revolt useless? No, not always. But we have to be very careful not to confuse the two. They are not the same, and indeed they can be there's something very dangerous about them. In the students' movements, some of them, Bader was not exactly a nice guy. Okay? There's something really troubling about this sort of celebration. Okay? Anarchy is not freedom. Revolt is not revolution. Now, I'm not saying that the Surrealists did not... It wasn't an important revolt. Yes, it was a revolt against the church. There's very little doubt. It doesn't matter whom you're reading, okay, in France at the time. Let's face it, we're talking Catholicism in particular, whether we talk, if you look at all the various texts. And they're looking mostly at texts, incidentally. They're not looking at the paintings so much, but the texts in particular. But it's not that they're not important, but we have to understand the real difference between revolt and revolution. And that occurs in the letter, in the exchange on the letters, and in particular on the issues in relation to Baudelaire. So in Paris, capital of the 19th century. Okay, that's a really important part of the Arcades project, but of the study as a whole. So that's, and it's extremely rich, but it has to be read very carefully. So I hope I clarified at least a little bit.
At the end of the book, you write the following, and this is a quote: "The critique of religion from Spinoza on, properly understood, has never assumed that reason or spirit can supersede religion. Rather, it seeks to understand religion as a material psychic need and respond to its power as mass power by excluding it from politics rather than repressing or accommodating it. Religion repressed leads to regression rather than revolution. Religion accommodated leads to the usurpation of politics by religion." Unquote. And you've already commented on this to some degree. As we face a U.S. election season where religion invariably plays a part in political discourse, what would count as an excluding of religion from politics? And getting back to the whole question of your optimism or lack thereof.
Okay, let's begin by absolutely not. I'm, if anything, not at all optimistic. Okay, as I said, and I'm less and less so in the age, as I call it, of sham revolutions and bit information. Okay, the more we rely for knowledge, it's not knowledge, for a semblance of knowledge on this kind of immediate bits on social networks, etc., we have lost. Absolutely. We've lost the capacity for experience, we've lost the capacity for thinking. So, before we get to American politics, let's get to local politics. Okay, today that is the mayoral race will be decided. Right. If you take a look at what happened, never in the past, okay, has the question of religion come into mayoral races. Never. Okay. And here it was brought. What happened? The mayoral candidate was accused of atheism and that disseminated like wildfire. There's something absolutely obscene about it, the use of religion. I'm not the first. I know many clergy, many members of the clergy, who wants precisely to separate religion. I mean, Spinoza is not the first. Adorno, Benjamin, etc., they're not the first. The first, I mean, you can go all the way to John of Paris, to Marsilius of Padua, okay, a Franciscan. And not Marsilius was affiliated, but Occam, okay. Admittedly, he had to escape to Bavaria to escape persecution. But no, it's within the church that resistance occurred from the beginning. There's a full recognition. There's a problem. So the desire for the separation, and incidentally, coming full circle, the desire for the separation when we get to Marsilius of Padua. The defensor pacis, okay, the defender of the peace, Whom does he quote? Averroes. My friend Averroes. Absolutely essential. Because in the Islamic tradition, indeed, it is Kalam and Al-Ghazali that represses philosophy and sees the end of philosophy, which is to say the end of the possibility of critical self-reflection. The end of the possibility of critique. Where there is no critique, it's not politics. We have lost the social. Social media is not social space. We have lost it. In other words, it's a complete destruction of the political by silencing, among other things. Take a look at this caricature that is loved by all the Republicans and whoever. The man is a caricature. And he doesn't say anything of substance. He just calls everybody else stupid. And
for future listeners, I think you're referring to Donald Trump.
Yes, indeed, I'm referring to Donald Trump. Okay. Absolutely. I mean, there is something, and again, the use of rhetoric, the use of religion, should be an offense to religious people. I don't mean just to those of us who are not. Should be an offense to religious people, because indeed it is the deployment of religion for personal gain. It precisely, it is really a denigration, not just of religion, but of bodies, of bodies, of suffering, of humans. Who cares about the candidate's religious affiliation? Will they be good to the community? And what has this, bringing religious discourse in, is absolutely divisive. What did he do here? What is he doing in this country? It is divisive. That's it. It spreads division. So I cannot. So am I optimistic? Oh no! Oh no! 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 I'm many things, but I'm not naive. I've been accused of many things, but not naivety. And as I say, seriously, we didn't have time to talk about experience, but that's highly complicated, and we have to understand difference. What do we mean by experience, philosophically speaking? But by you, I mean the right. Listener. But to me, the loss of the capacity for experience, okay, is the loss of the capacity for critical self-reflection. And critical self-reflection is the very possibility of freedom. So am I optimistic? No. No. But that's not to say that I will stop teaching or acting or being or critical. Writing, okay. Right. That's the point is not... Adorno never resigned, okay, nor do I, okay? Not at all. Horkheimer, unfortunately, did. But no, I do not resign. Whatever little intervention I can affect still matters. A little bit. A little bit.
Well, on that somewhat optimistic note, I want to thank you again for agreeing to be interviewed and for this interview.
Thank you. Thank you for interviewing me. It was a pleasure.
Again, I've been talking with Idit Dobbs-Weinstein, Associate Professor of Philosophy, Jewish Studies, and the Graduate Department of Religion about her recent book, Spinoza's Critique of Religion and Its Heirs, Marx, Benjamin, Adorno, published by Cambridge University Press. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thank